Okay, thanks for coming. My name is Aggie, and I will be teaching the front-end introductory quantum mechanics course. If you need to get in touch, you can email me at abranchik@pitp.ca. I never know how to spell Perimeter Institute properly, so I just use this alias. It also works for your email addresses if you want. You may have noticed that I have a speech impediment. The clinical term for this is an Australian accent. I was not born this way, but it developed over time. Australia is a wild country with lots of crazy insects, and most people learn to speak with their mouths closed. So, if I mumble at all throughout this lecture, just let me know if you didn't understand something. I won't be offended, and I'll be happy to repeat it. This course is by no means going to be an exhaustive course in quantum mechanics. It's not even going to be an exhaustive introduction to quantum mechanics. It's just a selection of topics that I thought it would be really helpful for you guys to be reminded of before you start the rest of the courses in PSI. So, in the four lectures that we're going to have this week, I'll start off talking about the wave function and talk a little bit about how we can interpret it. And I'll mention how to solve the one-dimensional Schrödinger equation. And tomorrow's lecture, we'll talk a little bit about the three-dimensional Schrödinger equation and the hydrogen atom, and we'll extend this to angular momentum and spin and addition of angular momentum. On Thursday, we'll talk a little bit about path integrals. So I'll derive the propagator in quantum mechanics in terms of the path integral formalism. And then in the last lecture, we'll talk about density matrices and how they arise, why they're necessary, and how they're related to probabilistic mixtures of quantum states, and also how we can use them to describe subsystems of larger entangled states. So I think probably the first three lectures will all be stuff you're familiar with. Maybe the fourth lecture, not so much. How many of you guys have studied density matrices? Okay, so that's well, that's actually quite good, like almost more than half. Okay, anywho, so let's start off this lecture with the wave function. So as a precursor to this, let's consider what happens in classical mechanics. So in classical mechanics, we can consider a particle of mass m. And it's, let's say it's constrained to just one direction, the direction x. And it has a force that's applied as a function of x and t. And what we're interested in is finding the position of this particle as a function of time. And once we do this, we can figure out, for example, the velocity, the momentum, kinetic energy, and really any other dynamical variable that you're interested in. And so, how do we get x of t? Well, we can do this by solving Newton's second law, F equals ma. And for conservative systems, this force can be expressed as the derivative of the potential energy. So we can write Newton's second law as m double derivative with respect to t equals minus del v del x. And so with this equation and appropriate initial conditions, we can solve it and get x as a function of t. So that's nice and simple, and probably more simple than what you guys did in David's classical mechanics course, right? My God, I had a look at like the first lecture, just skipped through it, and it seemed really scary. So I think it'll be more gentle in this course. Okay, so that's great. That's classical mechanics. What about quantum mechanics? So in quantum mechanics, we can't really talk about the position of a particle anymore, x of t. And we'll come to this, why this is the case at the end of the lecture. But instead, we deal with an object called the wave function, which, actually, let's start. So in quantum mechanics, we deal with the wave function, which we can write as psi of x of t. And that's the object that describes the state of our quantum mechanical system. And so we can get the wave function by now solving Schrodinger's famous equation, which we can write as this differential equation. And for pretty much the rest of this lecture, we're going to just consider a non-relativistic single particle. So in that case, so for a single particle, we have a Hamiltonian that looks like minus h bar on 2m del squared del x squared plus some potential. And so then for the single particle Schrodinger equation, we can write down so throughout this lecture, we're going to be coming back to this equation. Now, I see a bunch of you are writing notes. I have put these up on the wiki. So I mean, at the moment, it's just the first lecture. But everything I'm saying is like in a nice typed up PDF. So you don't have to take notes unless you want to. OK, so now we have a nice equation that we can solve to get this wave function psi, which describes the state of our particle. But how do we actually interpret this wave function? And so like in classical mechanics, we're used to thinking about a localized point. But here, it's this like funny object. And thanks to Max Born, we've got a statistical interpretation of this wave function. So Max Born says that we can think of the modulus squared of psi, actually. So psi squared can be thought of the probability of finding the particle at position x at time t. And so the interesting thing is that if you look at Max Born's original paper, which I actually I have a screenshot of the page of interest, and it's at the back of the notes, so you can look at it later. But if you look at this paper, it says, if one translates this result into terms of particles, only one interpretation is possible. And the interpretation that he writes is that psi gives the probability. So, I mean, that's not right, is it? And so if you actually look at this paper, you'll see there's this sentence, psi gives the probability, and then there's a little asterisk. And if you then go to the bottom of the page and you read what the asterisk says, it says addition and proof. So I believe what this means is that the paper was almost ready to publish. They were just looking at the proofs, and he decided, oh, I actually like need to change something. So addition and proof, more careful consideration shows that the probability is proportional to the square of the quantity psi. And so he went on to win the Nobel Prize for this little footnote, which I think is interesting. So OK, great. We've got the modulus squared gives the probability. And we can be more precise. And we can say that if we integrate over x from a to b, we're going to get the probability of finding the particle between a and b at a given time t. And so we can draw the wave function, or some sort of representative wave function. And so this quantity is the area under the graph, represents the plot probability. And for this particular wave function, we've got a really high probability of finding the particle within the vicinity of x equals a. And we have a really low, almost negligible probability of finding the particle within b. Yes?
I was just curious, in the important original paper, did he treat psi as a complex function or as a real function?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I don't know the answer to that. Let me just look at this one page and see if it's clear. I mean, I would guess that he was thinking of it as a real function because
right,
it would be weird to...
Sense.
Yeah. So it would be interesting to go back and actually like read the paper in detail, and maybe you'd like to do that. I have a reference to here. And you can tell us in the tutorial tomorrow, yeah? But very good question. Okay. Okay, so as I was saying, we've got high probability of finding the particle in the vicinity of A, low probability of finding the particle of the vicinity of B. And like, this is kind of weird. It introduces some kind of uncomfortable philosophical notions. So Newtonian mechanics is deterministic in the sense that given accurate knowledge of a position's particle, of a particle state, the position and velocity, then we can calculate the state of the particle from the laws of classical mechanics, at any point, future point in time, as we saw at the beginning of this lecture. But in quantum mechanics, everything that we know about a particle state is encoded in the wave function. And even if you know this wave function precisely, you can't predict the outcome of an experiment that measures the particle's position. So this is kind of bizarre. And I mean, you can ask the question, is this indeterminism a fact of nature, or is it a defect of the theory? And we don't really know the answer to that. This is something that people argue about to this day. And it really just depends on your interpretation of quantum mechanics, which is something we're not going to go into in this course. But I just wanted to give you a gist of the feel and gist of the arguments that people use. So if you decide to take on the realist interpretation, where you think that the particle really did have a definite position before the measurement, then you must concede that quantum mechanics is an incomplete theory, that you need something additional to describe the state of the particle. So for example, a hidden variable. You may have heard about hidden variable theories. Otherwise, if you think that the process of measurement actually like forced the particle into this position, then you have to be okay with the fact that we've got these two different laws of evolution in quantum mechanics. That we have one law that tells us that the particle evolves unitarily according to Schrodinger's equation, except for the case when we make a measurement and then some like crazy non-unitary thing happens that people call the collapse of the wave function. And that's like kind of weird as well. Like, why would we have one law of physics most of the time except when we interfere with it and make a measurement? And so this is something that people debate. And we'll definitely talk about this in Lucien Hardy's course on Foundations of Quantum Mechanics in next semester. So I encourage you to take that course because it's really fun. Okay, so that's all I wanted to say about interpretations. And yes, Dylan.
Is collapse of the wave function really not unitary, or is it just discontinuous?
I believe it's not unitary. Do you want to comment?
I don't know.
Well, it doesn't come out for the...
It doesn't satisfy Schrodinger's equation.
But, unitary means conserving probabilities, right? But if you plot the wave function, your total probability is still
Well, but then you have to go through this step of renormalization, which is kind of like an additional step. So I guess if you include renormalization of the state after the measurement, then it preserves the probability. But it seems like a really like weird nonlinear thing. It's like, yeah.
It's so not like, it's not like part of a one parameter family jump, but I think that jump is still like in the unitary.
Okay, I'm happy to say it's discontinuous and we'll leave whether it's unitary next time. Okay. Great. Okay, so now I just want to make a few comments about normalization of the wave function. So for the statistical interpretation to make sense, we need the sum of all of the probabilities to equal to 1. So we can write this down. So this means the sum of all of the probabilities is equal to 1. And if we look at Schrodinger's equation, we see that if psi is, we see that it's linear in psi. And so if psi is a solution, then any complex constant multiplying psi is also going to be a solution. And so we need to make sure that this constant A is chosen such that this equation is satisfied.
Okay. You're saying like complex constant and norm one, right?
Say again.
Constant complex number like that has on the unit circle.
I'm leaving it general what that number is. What I'm trying to say is that if you find a solution to this equation which does not satisfy this constraint, you need to multiply that solution by a constant parameter that will then satisfy this constraint. Okay. But there are also other solutions to Schrodinger's equation that don't satisfy this, even up to some complex constant. And these solutions are when psi is equal to 0. Or if... Where is it? Where this integral is infinite. So both of these, so where, let's call this 1. So we get non-physical solutions when psi is equal to 0 or when equation 1 is infinite. And so this is an important thing to remember, is that only solutions to Schrodinger's equation that are square integrable are considered to be physical. And so we'll come to it a little bit later again, like as to why these solutions are unphysical. Okay, so great. We find a solution to Schrodinger's equation that's square integrable. We find that it normalizes, that it's normalized according to this equation. But now we evolve it with time, and like, how do we make sure that it continues to stay normalized? And so it's like a really peculiar fact, or maybe it's obvious to some of you guys, but it's peculiar to me that Schrodinger's equation just naturally maintains the normalization, which is cool. And it's something we're going to prove in the tutorial tomorrow as well, because I don't want to go through the proof here. So that's important to remember as well. Okay. Right, so we've talked about the wave function describing the state of a particle. We can interpret the wave function, if we square it, we can interpret it as a probability, and it has to be normalized to set, for this interpretation to make sense. But now we would like to know, how do we actually get the wave function? And we do this by solving Schrodinger's equation, which I will show you how to solve for the time-independent Schrodinger equation case. So, do I need to rewrite it? I don't think so. Okay. And so we're only going to consider the case where V is independent of time, because that's a nice case where we can actually get analytical solutions. Often, if V is dependent of time, you have to do use special techniques like perturbation theory. And we're not going to get to that in this course. Okay, but if V is independent of time, we can use this trick called separation of variables. And we can write down big psi of x of t as a separable function of little psi of x and little phi of t. And so now I can rewrite the Schrödinger equation. As IH 1 on phi, where phi is still dependent on t. I don't want that yet. Spoiled it. Okay. So on the left side, we only have things that depend on t, and they change as a function of t. On the right side, we have things that only depend on x, or at least they don't depend on t, and they only change as a function of x. And so the only way that these two sides can be equal is if they're equal to a constant, which I'm just calling e for reasons that are probably obvious already. And so now what we have is two equations that we can solve. The left-hand side is equal to a constant, and the right-hand side is equal to a constant. And we're going to solve these equations separately. Okay, so for equation two, we have d phi dt is equal to minus I on h bar e phi. And this is really simple to solve. Just multiply by dt and integrate. And you get phi of t is equal to e to the I on h bar e on t. So this is just a complex number that oscillates as a function of time depending on the energy that, on E, this separation constant E. And for the second equation, which itself has the name the time-independent Schrödinger equation, we can write down h bar squared on 2m d squared psi on dx squared. And to solve this equation, we're going to need a little bit more information about the Hamiltonian of a specific system. But before we do that, I wanted to mention a few important things about this equation. So because we use this technique of separation of variables, the solutions that we're going to get here are not going to be all of the possible solutions to the Schrödinger equation. But the solutions that we do get have these interesting properties. So let's write them down. Okay. Okay, so the first one is that the solutions are all going to be stationary states. So even though big psi of x of t itself is going to depend on time, so it's a product of the function that depends on x and the function that depends on t. Oops. So this is time dependent, but if we look at the probability, then these complex phases are going to cancel out, and we're just going to be left with something that doesn't change as a function of t. So that's a stationary state. And also, the phases cancel out when we calculate expectation values. So if we, let's say, calculated the expectation value of x, you can see that that's going to be independent of time and is therefore a constant. And so we can also infer from that that the expectation value of momentum is going to be zero because there's nothing changing with respect to time. And again, we can say that these are that nothing ever happens in a stationary state. And so I haven't talked about expectation values in this lecture, but it's something that we'll cover in tomorrow's tutorial as well. Okay, so that's one thing, they're stationary states. Then the other important thing is that they're states of definite energy. And then the third thing, which I guess I'll put up here because it's important, is that even though the solutions that we have are not all of the solutions that we can get for the Schrodinger equation, you can construct all of the solutions by taking linear combinations of these separable solutions. So the general solution can be written down like this. Okay, and so you can see now, so the coefficient Cn just need to satisfy the appropriate conditions for the state to be normalized. But you can see here now, if you have more than one term in this sum, and if you take the absolute value squared, then you're not going to have all of the phases cancelling out completely. You'll have something that's time dependent. So anytime you have a superposition of these stationary states, it's not going to be a stationary solution. It changes with time. But if you're in just one of the particular states, then we call this a stationary state. Okay, great. So now for the rest of the lecture, I just wanted to show you a few toy examples that give us some nice intuition about how quantum systems behave and how they look. And so we're going to consider the infinite square well, which is the famous particle in a box problem. We'll also talk about the harmonic oscillator and the free particle. So So for a particle in a box, we have a potential that is zero if x is between zero and a point A, and it's infinity otherwise. So we can draw this potential as a function of x. So here we have 0, here we have A. These little arrows suggest that it's going off to infinity. And so the particle is free inside the box, but outside of the box, it's like it can't go there at all because these are infinite walls, so they prevent it from leaking into beyond the potential, into the potential. So we'll just shade this in to say that the particle can't go there. And so inside the well, we can write down Schrodinger's equation for a free particle. And the boundary conditions are going to tell us that the wave function here and the wave function there has to be equal to zero, since the wave function outside of the box is going to be zero. So to keep the wave function continuous, we're going to need it to be zero at this point and at this point. So we can write down okay, and now you can just like use your favorite technique for solving differential equations and take these boundary conditions into consideration, and you get a set of solutions. So you have a set of solutions that depend on n, where n is a positive integer. And each one of these wave functions has a corresponding energy, which is given by En as n squared pi squared h bar squared on to ma squared. And in this case, n is also a positive integer. And so what we see is that the particle can't take on any energy. It has to take on one of these specific energies given by En. Or it can take on a state that's a superposition of states in this energy. So let's just draw some of these wave functions. So for n equals 1, we have something that looks like that. N equals 2, like this. And N equals 3, it goes like that. And so we can make a few comments about these equations, these solutions. So you notice that they're alternating even and odd. So this is always true when your potential is symmetric. As you go up in energy, each successive state has an additional node. So you can see that the first one, apart from the edges, it didn't have any nodes. The second one had one node. The third one had two nodes. And this is always true, regardless of what potential you have. They're mutually orthogonal, so that's generally true. And they are complete, so they form a complete basis. And this is generally true for all physical states. Okay, and now that we have the solution to the time-independent Schrodinger equation, we can put this all together to find out what the general solution will look like. And we get psi of x of t is a sum from 1 to infinity, a constant. So again, we see that we've got something that is a linear superposition of different solutions. And each one of these has a phase that changes as a function of time, so that if we have a superposition of more than one of the stationary solutions, then even the probability is going to change as a function of time. Okay, the second toy model, we're going until 10:30, right? Yes. 10:30? No, 12. Oh, so we've got plenty of time, great. Okay, that can't be right. Am I reading that clock wrong? Is it only 10 past 11?
You got 50 minutes.
How much?
50 minutes.
Oh, we are so almost finished. So, early lunch. That's great. Okay, I'll just like walk around without saying anything for a while to drag this out. So harmonic oscillator. It's a great model. It's almost as simple as the particle in a box, but it's even more useful because in practice, almost any potential can be locally approximated as a parabola. So let's just draw some crazy potential. Okay, so any potential, as long as you're considering just a local approximation, then you can approximate this as a parabola and get the harmonic oscillator. So we can write down the potential energy. As half kx squared and the general Schrodinger equation that we need to solve. Is the same as always. Like that. And in this case, the Hamiltonian is going to be given by 1 on 2m p squared plus m omega squared, where omega is, you can think of it as a frequency that depends on the constant k and the mass of the particle. Okay, so we're going to use a different technique to solving the harmonic oscillator to what we used for the particle in a box. And this technique relies on factorizing the Hamiltonian. So if the Hamiltonian were just made out of numbers, rather than operators, this would be really simple. We could factorize like this. But the Hamiltonian consists of operators, so we can't just blindly go and do this, but it kind of suggests that we could consider some operators that are of this form. So these are two operators parametrized by either plus or minus, and we can define them as a constant out the front, minus plus ip plus m omega x. And so you can see here the p momentum operator corresponds to the u in this case, and the constant from the position operator corresponds to the v. And so in this case, we took a product of these two operators. So let's consider what happens if we take a product of these two operators, a plus and a minus. So let's now consider a minus times a plus. And you can work this out to be 1 on h bar omega times the Hamiltonian plus a half. And so what we get is an additional term of a half here that comes from the commutation relation of the creation operators. So let's just write these down. So the commutation relations for these operators, a plus and a minus, is commutator of a minus a plus is equal to 1. And you can derive this just from the standard commutation relations for momentum and position. Okay, so that's great. So we can now rewrite our Hamiltonian in terms of these operators, a plus and a minus. And it should be clear in a minute why we would like to do that. So you can write it either in terms of a plus a minus or the other way around. Okay, and then this would give us the Schrödinger equation. Okay, so this is like the big jump now that we're going to make. So here I have the Schrödinger equation, and we say that psi is an eigenstate of this equation with an eigenvalue of e. And so now I want to make the claim that if I act a minus on psi, that's going to be the solution to this equation with an eigenvalue e minus a half. And if I act the operator a plus on this state, it's going to also be the solution to this equation with an eigenvalue of e plus a half. And since I guess we're going well for time, I'm just going to prove that to you. So, I mean, from here, it's we can see that it's true for psi and energy e. So let's now act the Hamiltonian on A plus on psi, where the Hamiltonian is, we'll only choose one of these cases for now. And now what I want to do is multiply both of these terms by a dagger. But since these are operators, I can't just, you know, shuffle them around. But what I can do is bring a plus onto the left side and then pull out a minus, sorry, onto the right side and pull out a plus from the left side. So I can write this as that. And now I can use the commutation relation for a minus and a plus to rewrite this as follows. And again, I can notice now that this just corresponds to our original Hamiltonian, so I can write a plus h plus h bar omega psi. And we know that psi is an eigenstate of h with eigenvalue e, so we can replace the operator h by e. And now, because these are all numbers, the operator can just pass through, and we can write this. And so now we have an equation where a dagger psi is the eigenstate of this Hamiltonian with eigenvalue e plus h bar omega. And you can do the same thing for a minus acting on psi, and you'll get an eigenvalue of e minus h bar omega. So what this means is that if we can find just one solution that satisfies Schrödinger's equation, we can construct all of the other solutions just by adding operators a plus or a minus onto the state, and then we can infer what the energies are from the solution to this eigenvalue equation. Okay, so now the trick is to just find one solution. And so it's kind of a convoluted argument. Let's hope I don't stuff it up. Okay, but so if we have some sort of state with a particular energy and we keep acting the lowering operator, so these operators A plus and A minus can be thought of as raising and lowering operators because they raise the energy or they lower the energy. So if we keep acting the lowering operator on a particular state, eventually we're going to get to a state that has negative energy. And states with negative energies don't satisfy Schrödinger's equation. For a reason. They just lead to unnormalizable solutions to the Schrödinger's equation. And so this is unphysical. However, A minus acting on psi still has to be a solution of Schrödinger's equation, even though it's an unphysical solution. And so we conclude that for the lowest state that would then take you to a negative energy, the solution has to be that A minus acting on psi is just equal to zero. So we know that one of the states satisfies this solution. Okay, great. And because we have a definition for A minus, we can rewrite this as where I have now given this lowest solution, the subscript zero. And you can just solve this to get that psi of zero is a constant. So we have something like this. And so now it's just a matter of acting the raising operator on all of these solutions to find the continuum of solutions. Okay, and this thing has energy E0 equals a half h bar omega, which is the vacuum energy. Okay, so all other solutions, psi subscript n, can be calculated with an appropriate normalization constant, and the raising operator to the power of n acting on the lowest energy eigenstate, and then that gives us something that looks like this. Okay, so it's kind of gross. But so H subscript n is Hankel, or Hermite polynomial, and you guys are going to talk about properties of these in Dan's lecture on special functions, possibly tomorrow. So he can tell you more about those. And then the corresponding energies to the other solutions are given by En is n plus a half h bar omega. Okay. And just for fun, I'm going to quickly draw some of these potentials. Maybe I can do them here.
The system has detected that a minimum number of lines are connected to this conference. Do you want to continue your meeting? Press 1 to confirm. If there is no response, the conference will end.
Max? Identify some of the features that we were talking about before. So you can see as you go up in energy, we're going to be adding extra loads. Ultimately even and odd, so that's proving to be both symmetric potential. I'm not going to prove to you that they're mutually orthogonal, but they are, and they're also complete. Maybe Dan will talk about that. You can ask him about it. And so the final thing that I wanted to do was just talk about the three particles. Clock in my house, and so I just can't read that time. That's 11:30, right?
Yeah. Okay. Wait up. 11:30 is like one of the times. Oh, no, it'd be 11.
It's so, like if it was like 12:30.
Yeah, right.
Well, 12 is symmetric. Hang on, doesn't one of you believe time doesn't exist anyway? Was it you, Balsamid?
I don't know why everyone thinks that I. Maybe I don't.
You don't know.
No, if you believe, they will not believe. So.
Okay, yeah, free card. So the Hamiltonian is going to be exactly the same as for the particle in the box, except we have different boundary conditions. That's just right. Okay, and I'm not going to solve the differential equation again, but if you were to solve it, we would get this solution. in it, where we have A as a normalization constant and then we have a phase. So do we see anything wrong with, well, not wrong, but maybe concerning with this particular solution?
It's not square.
It's not
square.
A equals zero.
Yeah. Great. So it's not a square integrable, which means that it's not normalizable. So I won't bother writing that down with the equation, but I'll make it work. So if we try and normalize it, so what this tells us is that a free particle cannot exist in a stationary state. So there's no such thing as a free particle with a definite energy. But fortunately, as we did in the other cases, we can still use these solutions to construct physical solutions just by taking a linear superposition of these solutions. So we can write this down. So a general solution can be written as phi times of t is a normalization constant. And now instead of having a discrete sum, we have a continuous integral. Okay, so these things are called wave packets. So they carry a range of different values of k, and therefore they have a range of energies and velocities. And that is the last thing that I wanted to say today. So, I guess we have a little bit of time. Are there any questions at all?
Actually, in this last integral you put, we have to be the exponential, a term with h bar k squared over 2m. And in the left part, in the left part of the blackboard, we have the exponential of h bar k. Okay, so it's a square root. Thanks.
So have any of you guys actually looked at the course outline for the upcoming lectures?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No? Yes. Yes. I guess I wanted to ask if there's anything in particular that I haven't outlined there that maybe you would really like to see before we go on to the big lectures, because maybe I could speak something in. Okay, cool. So, yeah, that's pretty much all I wanted to say today, so we can go off to an early lunch. And tomorrow we're going to continue with the Schrodinger equation, but in three dimensions, and angular momentum. And these the Clebsch-Borden coefficient tables, which have been kind of scary, but I guess maybe we have fun with that. So thank you very much for your attention.